מה התוצאה?
ברוך הבא.
It's sort of been in the works, but it happened like there was a buyer for my house and Ames Bay dry and there we go.
It's all in the timing.
Yeah, well, I have both my two children and 10 grandchildren there.
Oh, that's a really good reason to move there.
And my yes. one granddaughter in Baltimore is going to move in July.
Oh, wow. So
won't have anyone.
Do you know where are you going to move to there?
And your boo.
Where they are in Carnation Row.
I don't even know where that is.
Keynote. Well, I don't know if you know, but the Wilbers live there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I know where that is. Yeah.
And Adele Margulies. And,
yeah.
Yeah. A lot of Anglos.
Oh, yeah.
How's everybody doing?
Hello, Robert.
Baruch Hashem.
Great.
Rabbi Sher, how are you?
Hi, Tzvi. I'm good. How are you? Thank you. Okay, so we're back, and I want to continue with the story of Yosef's, the sale of Yosef. As I said last time we met, you could break that story down, I think, into several parts. Last time we discussed the relationship between Yosef and his brothers and why they even intended to do away with him. That was last week's discussion. Today I want to focus on the actual sale of Yosef itself, being his encounter with his brothers, the way they treated him, the different thoughts about killing him or selling him, and then what actually happened. So I'm going to go through that story today. For those following in the Stone Chumash, I'm on page 203. It's Perek Lamed Zayin Pasuk Yud Beis in Sefer Bereishis. So the story we left off last time, that Yosef is sent down to visit his brothers in Shechem. His brothers had gone to Shechem to graze the sheep, and Yaakov tells Yosef, I want you to go down to Shechem and check on your brothers. So let's look at verse 12. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. So they were doing their job as shepherds. If you look in the Hebrew side, in a Sefer Torah you have this, the word S has two dots above it. There's actually several places you find in the Chumash where we have a Masorah, there's a tradition to actually put dots over certain letters. And whenever the dots are there, it always indicates something deeper, some other meaning, some other understanding. So Rashi says, why were there dots over the letter, over the word S? What do those dots mean? So Rashi tells us, Shulhochu el l'ros etz atzman. They didn't really go to graze the sheep. They went to graze themselves. So there was some, what's called selfish intent in their going out to Shechem. It wasn't just following their father's instructions, take care of my sheep. There was some focus on their own personal needs in going out there. So what was that focus? So one idea is that they just needed to get away from Yosef. They'd had enough of their brother giving them this aggravation, and going to graze the sheep for them was an escape. It was an excuse that we can be away on our own without Yosef, not deal with this frustration, this aggravation, and just focus on ourselves, have some time away. So that's not something that's necessarily bad. Sometimes it's a good technique if you're going through a tough time just to get away a little bit, you know, and you know, release the pressure. But that's one of the ideas behind Liros Atman. They were there grazing themselves beyond just grazing their sheep. Now in the next pasuk, verse 13, and Yisrael said to Yosef, your brothers are pasturing in Shechem, are they not? Come, I will send you to them. He said to him, here I am. They said to him, go now, look into the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring me back word. So he went from the depth of Hebron, and he arrived at Shechem. So this is the verse where Yaakov sends Yosef down to Shechem to check on the brothers. There's a few important points over here. Number one, the way that Yaakov is described here, we use the name Yisrael. We know that when Yaakov wrestled the angel, his name was changed to Yisrael, but the Torah often will alternate. Which name is used after that encounter varies. Sometimes it's called Yisrael, sometimes it's called Yaakov. The Netziv says the name Yisrael always connotes a higher spiritual element, and the name Yaakov connotes a more physical element. So when it says that Yisrael is the one who told Yosef to go to Shechem, the Netziv says that this is coming from some lofty ideal, meaning we'll talk about in a moment, this wasn't just a father saying, check on your brothers. there was some divine providence hashgacha here that was leading to the story to actually unfold. So V'yomer Yisrael means that the intention of Yaakov, whether it be consciously or subconsciously, was from a very high, lofty place to bring about the future, the destiny of Klal Yisrael. That's where it was coming from. Yosef says here the famous word, he says, Hineni. We know the word Hineni in Chumash we've discussed before is a word used by all those great tzaddikim when they're ready to take on a real task, a real mission. It's a word that implies humility. It's a word that implies readiness to do someone else's will. Avram said Hineni at the Akedah. We know that Yaakov said Hineni, Yitzchak said Hineni, we know that Yosef said Hineni, Moshe said Hineni. The word Hineni is used very often for those people taking on major tasks, even when they're difficult, but with a sense of submission to a greater authority, with a feeling of humility, of anava. So Yosef knew very well that this mission might be difficult. He knew there's risk involved. He knew his brothers hated him. He knew, I'm being sent off to the lions then over here. I have 10 brothers out in the fields that hate my guts, that would love to do away with me. I don't know what they're going to do. I guess he never dreamed they'd actually like sell him as a slave. You know, that's something that wasn't yet on his mind. But yet he knew it was dangerous. But when his father said, I want to give you this mission, I want you to go check on your brothers, Yosef didn't hesitate. He didn't say, what am I supposed to do? They hate me. It's dangerous for me. He said, Hineni, I know there's risk involved, but I'm going to do it with zrizus, with diligence, and with humility. And that's what he did. So Yosef now is on his way to fulfill this mission. And the other interesting term used over here in verse 14 is that it says he was sent from the depths of Hebron. Now, Rashi points out that Hebron is not in a valley. Hebron is at a higher elevation. So why this is Hebron Bahar. Hebron's on a mountain. So what does it mean, the depths of Hebron? Where are the depths of Hebron? Hebron is an elevated place. So Rashi quotes from the sages. Rashi tells us that this entire story was coming me'etza amuka, from the deep advice, or the deep, let's call it prophecy, of the one who dwells in Hebron. What's that referring to? Hebron is the city of the Marasach Pela, where the Avos and Imos are buried. Avram Avinu is buried in Hebron. And Hashem told Avram Avinu many years back that your children are going to be slaves in a nation that is not theirs, and they're going to work and they're going to suffer. And after that, they'll leave with great wealth. That was called the Bris Bein Bessarim. This was the guarantee or the deal, the covenant made between Hashem and Avram Avinu that we'll go through a period of suffering and we'll come out at the end as a nation, as Hashem's nation. So this, at this point, Yosef going to his brothers was going to be the catalyst for bringing the Jews down into Egypt. It's going to be the catalyst for the Jews to fulfill the prophecy given from Hashem to Avraham Avinu. So the Emet Hebron, the depths of Hebron, that doesn't refer to a geographical place. What that's referring to is the depth of the person, Avraham Avinu, who was buried in Hebron. And because Avram was buried in Hebron, and it was to him this prophecy was said, that's how this whole story begins. So we have to see this story not just as sibling rivalry, but there's also Ashkacha involved over here. Meaning it's actually a hard balance to understand. On the one hand, the brothers all had free choice, and what they did was wrong. We know that because the rabbis tell us they're punished for this, and we're still punished because of their actions, meaning it's something that remained a big blemish on the future of Klal Yisrael. On the other hand, there was divine providence involved. Hashem told Abraham that your children will be slaves in a foreign nation. So there are many ways in which Hashem could bring out that prophecy. It's on this point that many commentaries discuss the balance between human free will and divine providence and destiny. And in short, I mean, it's hard to understand. If Hashem says that the Jews will be slaves, we will be slaves, period. Now, how we get to slavery? Well, there are several possibilities how we can get there. And the brothers stepped up and they chose to be the ones to initiate that process. So they're the ones who are liable for it. They're the ones who are blamed. So on the one hand, Hashem's plan will come out into fruition. Hashem's plan will always be true. On the other hand, as humans, we have to make the right choices. And Hashem will figure out another way to make his plans true. For me to say, I'm going to enslave the Jews because Hashem said so. So no, it's wrong to enslave the Jews. If Hashem wants them enslaved, he'll make sure it happens. He has his own ways to make things happen. That's not your business. This is the famous question. Why are the Egyptians punished? Why were there 10 plagues? If Hashem said the Jews will be enslaved by a foreign nation, Paro can say, okay, I'm doing a mitzvah. I'm doing God's will. God said I should enslave the Jews, and here I am. The answer is, well, the Jews had to be enslaved, but not by you. No, you didn't have to be the one. The fact you chose to be the one, that's your bad decision, and you're the one who's liable for that. So this whole story, on the one hand, is the catalyst. It's triggering the exile into Egypt. It's coming to fulfill the promise or the prophecy given to Avraham Avinu that we will be slaves in a foreign land. On the other hand, it was the brothers who made the wrong decision by selling Yosef. So you have that balance here in the story. Let's look at the next verse, verse 15. A man discovered him, and behold, he was blundering in the field. The man asked him, saying, what do you seek? And he said, my brothers do I seek. Tell me, please, where are they pasturing? So in short, Yosef was wandering around trying to find his brothers. He didn't have a GPS, no Waze and no Google Maps. He couldn't find where they were. So a man saw him wandering around lost in the field and said, how can I help you? And he said, I'm trying to find my brothers. So the man said, they have journeyed on from here, for I heard them saying, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. So Torah spends here three psukim discussing Yosef asking for directions. As I've said many times before, the Torah does not give details that aren't necessary. That morning, Yosef ate breakfast and he put on his socks. It could be that he sneezed along the way, but that's not mentioned in the Torah anywhere. What's mentioned is that he's walking and asked for directions. I mean, why is that significant? Just skip to verse 18, that the brother saw him coming. Why do we care that he asked for directions? What exactly is that describing? So the rabbis tell us, who was this man? Who was the man that found Yosef wandering? And the rabbis tell us this is actually an angel. This is the Malach Gavriel. And the Malach Gavriel was the one who directed him where to go. So what does it indicate to us? It indicates to us this is all part of divine providence. This is Hashkacha. Hashem wanted Yosef to find his brothers. Hashem sent the Malach to serve as the GPS so he could find where to go. But that was all part of Hashem's plan. Because Yosef, he couldn't find them, would have gone back home and said, sorry, Dad, I can't find my brothers. And, you know, send someone else out. We'll go get a different time. But Hashem directed Yosef to his brothers because this is fulfilling a divine plan. So it's a fascinating thing. The Rashbam adds another point in. The Rashbam says that Yosef, at this point, had a great excuse to turn around. What's the best excuse? I tried. You know, I wandered around Shechem. I couldn't figure out where to go. They had already left. I wasn't sure where they went to graze the sheep. I just don't know. So he could have gone back to his father and said, I tried, but sorry, I wasn't able to accomplish the mission. And Yosef was tempted to do that. Why? Because he knew that his brothers hated him. He was entering into, as I said, the lion's den, dangerous territory. So he had a great excuse, but he persevered in the mission. Yosef did not say, okay, I give up. I'm going to use the excuse to turn back. Yosef went on to do his father's bidding. So it shows that how much Yosef persevered to follow his father's will. This is all part of the Hineni. This is all part of the I am ready to submit myself to you, Yaakov, even if I know that something that could be dangerous for me, I'm doing it anyways. So the Rashbam says on a simple level, the Torah telling us about Yosef's directions was telling us Yosef's commitment to his father's word. That's what it's telling us. Now, if we go to verse 18, it says, they saw him from afar, and when he had not yet approached them, they conspired against him to kill him. So we discussed last time this verse. And the Hebrew term, vayisnakloso, in short, the Sforno says, means that the brothers projected upon Yosef that Yosef was dangerous. I mean, we asked last time, what was their excuse? Like, how do they justify selling off their brother? So it can't be justified. But as the Shiftei cause, the tribes of Hashem, there has to be some rationale. And the rationale was, they saw Yosef as a dangerous person. They thought Yosef was out to get them, to be their master, to lord over them, to plot against them. So in this verse, the brothers saw him coming, and they actually themselves were concerned, Yosef's here to do evil to us. We better stop him in his tracks. He's a rodef. He's pursuing us to do something bad. So that's how the commentaries understand verse 18. Let's read 19 and 20. And they said to one another, look, that dreamer is coming. So now come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say, wild beast devoured him. Then we shall see what will become of his dreams. So the brothers speak to one another and they want to plot against Yosef. Now, the commentaries tell us which two brothers were the primary players in this conversation. It was Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi, the same ones that went in and destroyed the city of Shechem. Shimon and Levi are also the ones to plot against Yosef. And these two brothers are ones that we described as Kanoim. They were zealous. You know, they would stand up for what was true with a lot of passion, for better or for worse. So they're passionate about the fact that Yosef is dangerous. They're passionate about the fact that Yosef is coming to do something bad to them. So they're the ones who said, let's take him, let's kill him. He is a danger to the rest of us. We'll throw him in the pit and everyone will be happy besides Yosef. We'll all be okay. So they focus in on his dreams, because we discussed that the dreams are what really indicate to the brothers that Yosef had bad intentions over here. In the very last part of the verse, then we shall see what will become of his dreams. It's sarcastic. It's like, here comes the dreamer. Let's see about those dreams. Because the brothers didn't believe the dreams. The brothers still felt that Yosef's dreams were Yosef just projecting upon them what he wanted to do, what he felt. But they wanted to show these dreams are actually worthless. Let's see what happens with his dreams. Let's toss him in the pit and kill him and see what becomes of those dreams. Now Rashi says, has a different take on the pasuk. Rashi says, when it says over here, let's see what will come of his dreams, what it means is that's actually Ruach HaKodesh. That's Hashem talking. That's divine inspiration. The divine inspiration says, you're going to try to kill Yosef. It's not going to happen because those dreams are going to come true. So you can look at this as a brother as being sarcastic, or you can see this as a message from Hashem telling them it's not going to happen. These dreams are going to be fulfilled. These dreams are real. These dreams are prophecy. These dreams are genuine. And no matter what you try to do, you can't outsmart Hashem. So there's two ways to look at that line, and they're both true. Now, some commentaries say you can understand this line the following way. This is going to be the test if the dreams are true. I mean, how do you test it out? If Hashem wants the dreams to occur, he won't allow Yosef to be killed. If Hashem doesn't want them to occur, then he will allow them to be killed. Meaning if the dreams actually are real, Yosef will survive. If the dreams are fake, Yosef will be killed. So they wanted to sort of test it out. But ultimately, this is the brothers are ready to do something to stop Yosef in his tracks because they think Yosef is up to no good. That's what they feel. So let's look at the next verse, verse 21. My paper's over here. Verse 21, it says, Reuven heard, he rescued him from their hand. He said, we will not strike him mortally. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into the pit in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, intending to rescue him from their hand, to return him to his father. So Reuben, the firstborn, steps in and tries to, let's say, speak some sense, you know, knock some sense into them. He says, don't shed his blood. Don't kill him. Why Reuben? Why is Reuben the one who steps up and wants to save Yosef, of all the brothers? So Reuben, we know, was the Bechor. He was the firstborn. And Reuben understood that who is the one that stands to take the blame if something happens to Yosef? It's me. I'm the firstborn. I'm responsible. I'm the oldest. I'm the leader. And he felt that he had power, and he felt he had responsibility. So he discouraged it. He discouraged murdering Yosef. He felt, I'm the one. All the backlash will come to me if anything happens to Yosef. Now, it's important to note, if it was true that Yosef was out to get them and Yosef wanted to become the master over the tribes, who is the one who would be most affected? It'd be Reuven. I mean, on the one hand, Reuven stands to lose the most if Yosef actually comes and takes over because he right now is the leader. On the other hand, he has responsibility. He says, I am responsible for all the brothers because I'm the oldest. And I better knock some sense into these guys before they do something very stupid. So he stands up and says, don't murder him. Now, he discourages murder, but he does say it was toss him into a pit. So what was he thinking? Like, why did he say, don't murder him, throw him into a pit? That's a funny thing to say. So on the one hand, Reuven felt if I say, leave them alone, they won't listen to me. I have to show that I'm on their team. I mean, we know how it works. If there is a vicious crowd, you know, there's a mob, a bloodthirsty mob, and you say, you guys are bloodthirsty, you're crazy, don't do anything, they're going to come kill you. They don't care what you have to say. If you say, I'm with you, I agree with your cause, but I have a better solution, then they'll talk to you. That's just how it works. So Reuven said, if I say, leave him alone, he's not out to do anything wrong, let's make peace with him. The brothers would say, Reuven, you're crazy. He's dangerous, and they turn against Reuven. So Reuven said, no, I agree with you. Yosef has to be done away with. Yosef is dangerous, but let's not shed any blood. Let's throw him in a pit. Now, what's the idea over here? So the Or HaChaim says the following calculation. He says that if the idea here is to test, are the dreams real or are the dreams fake? So the Or HaChaim says, if human beings go ahead and kill Yosef, it doesn't prove anything. Why? And he says here a very important, we'll call philosophical point. He says, human beings have free choice. So even if someone doesn't deserve to die, if I go and I take a gun and put it to his head, then he'll die. I mean, this is something that could be debated in Hashkafa. Philosophically, it's, you know, there's different approaches to this. But do we say if a person is killed, is murdered by someone else, they actually deserve death? Or do we say, no, the murderer has free choice and he just took death into his hands. And even though the person didn't deserve death, he was killed. So the Or HaChaim takes the approach that if a human being kills another human being, chas v'shalom, a murder. So Or HaChaim says, if that's the case, then even if Yosef didn't deserve to die, he'll die anyways, because human beings have free choice, and I can choose to kill. On the other hand, the Or HaChaim says, if a person gets killed by natural means, by wild animals, by a storm, something along those lines, so there's no free choice involved in that. Animals don't have free choice, and the weather is no free choice. So if that happens, that means that Hashem has deemed the person worthy or necessary to die. And therefore, that would prove something. That would show that Yosef deserves death. So in other words, Reuven said, if we kill him, we've proven nothing. If we kill him and he dies, it could be that he's totally innocent. He's a loving, caring brother who is not out to do anything wrong to us. And we are murderers. If we throw him in a pit, he dies by means of wild animals or snakes or scorpions or any other natural cause, then we know that Hashem has proven to us that he deserves to die. Whereas if he survives that, we know he deserves to live. That was the logic behind Reuven saying, throw him into the pit rather than have us kill him. Now the Medrash tells us, the Medrash says that ultimately Reuven did want to save Yosef. And the Medrash says here, there's a very beautiful Medrash. And it says, had Reuven realized that the Torah was writing down these actions, he would have taken Yosef on his shoulders and run him back to Yaakov on his shoulders. So the Medrash goes on with a few other stories throughout Tanakh with the same idea. It says it about Boaz and Rus. It says it about, I forgot, one other story. There's three stories where the Torah says that had they realized this was being written down in the Torah for eternity, and everyone would know about this story, then they would have, you know, taken on the task and done it in a much more meaningful way. So what does that mean? Let's explain that Medrash. Let's say the story again. So Reuven, had he realized this is being recorded in the Torah, he would have picked up Yosef, put him on his shoulders, and raced back to Yaakov and saved his life. So what's that describe about Reuven? It was a publicity stunt. You know, had he known that he'd be famous for this, he would have done it better. What does it mean? So being recorded in the Torah means that this action has eternal meaning. This is a seminal point in the history of Klal Yisrael. This is determining destiny. So Reuven thought, you know, okay, this is something between us brothers. This is something important. I have to protect myself and protect Yosef the best I can. But I don't see this necessarily as a defining point in history. So therefore, I'll do whatever I can to survive and to work through it. I'm not going to take it on fully. On the other hand, had Reuven realized it's being written in the Torah, which means this incident happening in front of me is going to be a central point for the destiny of Klal Yisrael. This is going to change the course of history. this is going to be recorded in the Torah for all eternity, not just because it's a story and because it has eternal meaning, then I would have looked at the whole situation differently. I would have done the mitzvah with a full heart, the Midrash says, you know, with much more diligence and much more confidence, because I would know how much this means historically. So the lesson there is that deep down, Reuben understood, I want to save Yosef. He had his concerns for himself. He has concerns about Yosef, but he thought the right thing would be to save him. However, he didn't realize that we're dealing here with not just sibling rivalry, not just an extreme case of brothers against brothers. We're dealing here with a story that would impact the whole future of the world. He didn't realize that. So he didn't do it full-heartedly, the Medrash says. So the lesson for us is that we have to know the power of our actions. We don't ever know what action of ours is going to have eternal meaning. You know, all of us in our own lives do things that could change the course of history for ourselves, for our family, for our friends, for our communities. You know, the destiny of the world is in our hands. And some things we do are not necessarily related to the destiny of the world. Some things we do are. We don't know what decision in our life is going to impact others. It's going to impact the future. So sometimes it won't. If I decide this morning, should I eat cornflakes or Cheerios? Okay, it most likely won't impact the future of the world. But sometimes things will. And if we knew that this is being written down in Hashem's books as an action which determines destiny, determines the future, we would be much more alert and focused on how we do it. We would do it, as the Midrash says, with a full heart, with a lev shalem. So we have to the power of our actions. We have to know we have so much power in our hands. And we also have to know that actions have consequences. Reuben understood that this is important to do, but had he known the consequence of his action, he may have done it differently. So that's what Torah describes. So on the one hand, Reuven is discouraging his brothers from murder. Reuven does suggest throw him into the pit. That's what he suggests. He doesn't want to kill him, but deep, deep down, Reuven would like to save him. And that's what the Torah tells us. The Torah says, the end of verse 22, intending to rescue him from their hand, to return to his father. That was ultimately his intent. So why didn't he pick him up and run him home? Because he didn't do the mitzvah of lev shalom. It wasn't done with a full heart. He didn't realize, you know, what was at stake over here. And he was a little bit too passive. So that's verse 22. Now, verse 23, it says, and so it was when Yosef came to his brothers, they stripped Yosef of his tunic, the fine woolen tunic that was on him. And they took him and cast him into the pit. The pit was empty. No water was in it. So Yosef finally approaches, the brothers come and they take off his coat. The Torah refers to here the Ksonas Pasim, the famous coat that Yaakov made for Yosef. They strip him of that coat and they throw him into a pit. It says the pit had no water, and the rabbis tell us there was no water, but there were snakes and scorpions inside the pit. So it wasn't such an easy pit to be in. Miraculously, the snakes and scorpions did not bite Yosef, and he survived being in that pit. They stripped him of this coat. Now we know the coat was one of the sources of the jealousy between the brothers to Yosef. But I did see that one commentary points out, if you look at the wording of the pasuk says that they, by Yefshitu es Yosef's kutanto, they stripped off his tunic, eskesonis hapasim, his kesonis pasim was the famous coat that Yaakov gave to Yosef, asher alav. So there's double wording here. In the English it says the tunic, the fine woolen tunic. So what's the double wording? So some commentaries explain that Yosef did not wear his kesonis pasim, his famous, you know, beautiful coat on the top. He wore it under his clothes. So we picture Yosef walking around wearing his beautiful coat, showing everybody, my father loves me the most, and I'm wearing this very, very beautiful coat because of it. So we picture that, and then Yosef is walking around sort of bragging, sort of showing off, you know, in an arrogant way. This verse implies that wasn't true. Yosef wore the coat under his clothing because he wanted to wear it because he felt that closest to his father. He didn't want to show off. He didn't want to brag. So he wasn't trying to show off to his brothers. His intention wasn't to show them, look at me, my father loves me more than you. So he wore on top of it another tunic, and he wore this fancy coat under his tunic. Doesn't sound so comfortable in the hot Middle Eastern sun, but that's what he did. And the idea was that Yosef had no intentions to be arrogant. That wasn't his intent. It does imply here in verse 23 that Yosef did not resist. it says Yosef came, they stripped him of his tunic, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Nowhere does it say that Yosef resisted the brother's attack. I don't know why. I don't have an answer to that. It's something that I'd like to think about, understand more. Why wouldn't Yosef fight back? So I don't have a good answer for that question. Everyone's welcome to do some research or think about it on their own. But the implication is that Yosef didn't fight back. He just, you know, he just kind of took it as it came. In verse 25, it says they sat to eat food. They raised their eyes and they saw, behold, the caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, their camels bearing spices, balsam, and lotus on their way to bring them down to Egypt. So verse 25, Yosef is in this pit and the brothers sit down for a meal. So commentaries sort of argue over what this meal was all about. But to me, the implication seems to be that they sat down with a totally clear conscience. I mean, they didn't feel bad about this. And this really goes back to what we discussed last week. The brothers felt totally justified in this action. They didn't feel it as an act of jealousy or an act of revenge or anything inappropriate. They felt this is totally appropriate. The same way you described, the brothers would convene a beis din. They could convene a court and rule that Yosef deserved to be killed because they felt Yosef was going to attack them. He was going to undo the entire structure of the future of Klal Yisrael. So when they threw him in the pit, they felt totally confident and comfortable with that action. You know, usually if you feel uneasy about something, you feel guilty, you'll sit down for a meal right away and just sit there enjoying your meal. You can't eat. You have no appetite. You're worried. It sounds like the brothers had a totally clear conscience. They weren't worried about the act. They felt it was the right thing to do. They felt justified. There's no guilt and there was no shame. So it's interesting, but that sort of plays into the idea we spoke about last week, how the brothers felt this is a totally justified act. They didn't feel that they were overtaken by some sort of passion or jealousy or Yitzhahara. They felt that this was halachically the right thing to do. In the same way, if a court rules, you don't question the psak. We ruled Yosef deserves to be killed or sold. So we don't even question our psak. That psak stands, that ruling is right and finished. So that's the brothers sat down to eat. Now the Torah then describes these caravans coming by, and it says the caravan was carrying spices and balsam and lotus on their way down to bringing them down to Egypt. So Rashi says, why do we care what the caravan was carrying? Had it been spices? Had it been fish? Had it been shoes? Had it been, you know, concrete, oil? It doesn't matter what it is. The point is there was a caravan going to Egypt that Yosef would be sold to. So I've mentioned before, but I think it's such a beautiful idea. I'll just say it again in short. Chaim Shmulevitz, he would say that this pasuk is telling you about something very, very meaningful and significant. What is that? So Rashi says that typically these caravans did not carry beautiful smelling spices. These caravans going down to Egypt by the Arabs usually would be carrying things that smell terrible, those sulfur and kerosene and things that would have a very, very difficult smell, very terrible smell. The one that happened to pick up Yosef smelled lovely. It smelled like perfume, it smelled like potpourri. It was a beautifully smelling caravan. And Chaim Shmulevitz says that sometimes Hashem does miracles for people, not because they're necessary, but just to show you that I'm with you. You know, there are miracles that are necessary out there. You know, if the Jews are fighting against, you know, Haman, Perm is around the corner, and Haman's going to commit genocide and kill the entire nation. So it's quote unquote necessary for Hashem to save us, because if he doesn't, then we're done. We're dead. We're toast. Finished. But a miracle like this, I mean, whether it smelled in the caravan like sulfur, whether it smelled like perfume, it doesn't really change Yosef's destiny. Yosef is being sold as a slave. In his mind, he'll never see his father again. He's being cut off from the 12 tribes. He's about to enter into a very terrible part of his life. So who cares if it smells on the way down to Egypt like kerosene or like perfume? What's the difference? But the answer is this is miraculous, because Yosef understood that this caravan I'm in that smells nice is a kiss from Hashem. Hashem is telling me, don't worry, Yosef, I'm with you. Even though it looks like your life is over and you're going to be cut off never to come back again, don't worry, I'm here with you for the journey. So that's why it smelled so nice in the caravan. And this is an example of a miracle which was not necessary, but was just Hashem gesturing to us or to Yosef that I'm with you, I care about you, I love you personally, And don't worry, I'll get you through this. So it's not beautiful in the caravan on the way down. In verse 26, so he hasn't yet been sold. The Torah described the caravan coming by. So now Yehuda jumps in. So Yehuda said to his brothers, what gain will there be if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Like, if we leave Yosef in the pit and just leave him to die, or we kill him, like, what do we gain from that? Like, what is our benefit? So what does he mean? So based on the commentaries, it means the following. I'll quote you the Sforno. The Sforno says that there are two possible things that we want to gain from killing Yosef. One would be some form of revenge, that people who do evil have to bear the consequences. And number two would be to deter in the future that no one else should do what Yosef's doing. They felt Yosef was coming to, you know, take over the 12 tribes, coming to sort of hijack the future of Klal Yisrael. So it should be deterrent. But they said, number one, in terms of the revenge, to do bad to bad people, if we kill Yosef, it'll hurt us too. We're going to bear the suffering of this for our entire life. So we don't gain from that. In terms of deterring others, if we kill him, we're not gonna publicize it. If we kill Yosef, we're not talking about it. No one's gonna know we did this. So how is that a deterrent for anybody else? Because if no one knows about it, it can't deter someone else from doing the wrong thing. So Yehuda says, let's sell him, and then it'll be Mida Keneged Mida. Why? If we sell him, so he will be punished and we'll gain the money. And number two, if the whole issue was he wanted to take over, he wanted to be the Lord over us, he wanted to be our master, so we sell him to slavery and he'll end up being someone else, having someone else as his master. Meaning it's measure for measure, Mida Keneged Mida, because if his crime was he wants to take over the 12 tribes and be the leader, so his punishment will be that he'll be taken over by someone else. He'll be a slave and he'll have a different master. He wants the Lord over us, he'll have to have his own Lord. And that's the idea. So the suggestion of Yehuda is let's sell him rather than kill him. And that'd be best for everybody. So it says further, come let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, but let our hand not be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. His brothers agreed. And then it gets very confusing. In verse 28, it's very unclear, and the commentaries speak at length, who sold him to who. In verse 28, it says, Midianite men, traders, passed by. They drew Yosef up and lifted him out of the pit and sold Yosef to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. They brought Yosef to Egypt. So was he sold by the brothers? Was he sold by the Midianites? Was he sold by the Ishmaelites? Like who exactly sold him to who and when? Very unclear in the Psukim. Rashi says simply, whoever happened, Yosef was sold numerous times on this journey. I mean, the slave markets work. You buy a slave, you sell the slave. You can sell them for profit. So Yosef was sold along the journey many, many times. And one of the ideas that we have to pull out of that is you always ask the question, you know, why did the brothers later on try to find Yosef? And furthermore, when the brothers went to Egypt, why were they so surprised that Yosef was there? So the answer is because since Yosef was sold so many times along the way, the brothers figured that he's lost forever. They lost track of him. They didn't expect him in Egypt because even though the caravan they sold was in Egypt, they knew Yosef would be sold several times over before he was done. So for all they knew, Yosef could have been sold off to Japan. Like they had no idea where Yosef was because Yosef was sold many times. So he happened to end up in Egypt. But the brothers had no way to know that because since these caravans sold off their slaves over and over and over again, Yosef could have been anywhere. So the story goes, he was sold. Reuben returns to the pit in verse 29, and behold, Yosef is not in the pit, so he rent his garments. So the implication was Reuben had left. He wasn't there at the time of the sale. Reuben goes back to the pit expecting Yosef to be there, and when he sees Yosef not there, he tears his clothing as a sign of mourning. And the idea was, we said before, Reuben felt that Yosef should be returned to the father. He didn't do his mitzvah properly. He did not take him back at the moment when he had the chance. And when he came back from wherever he was, he saw Yosef was gone, it was too late. He missed his chance. For us, it's a lesson. If you have a chance to do something good, do it right away. No, you don't push off a mitzvah. You don't push off doing good for somebody else. Reuben pushed it off. He stalled, he delayed, and he came back, and it was too late. He lost the opportunity. So in verse 30, returning to his brothers, he said, the boy is gone. And I, where can I go? So Reuven said, Yosef is gone. And basically, what's happened to me? I'm in trouble now. Reuven felt alone in this. He felt that he was the only one to stand up for Yosef. And he felt that now I'm going to be blamed for all that happened. So in verse 31, they took Yosef's tunic, slaughtered a goatling, and dipped the tunic in blood. They dispatched the fine woolen tunic, and they brought it to their father and said, we found this. Identify, if you please, is it your son's tunic or not? So in the Hebrew, it says, they tell Yaakov, can you identify this coat? Is it your son's or not? So this is where Yaakov is going to break down in tears. Yaakov can't bear the loss of his favorite son. But it's very reminiscent of Yaakov's own personal challenge that he had many years back. We know that Yaakov put on Esav's coat and went to fool his father to get the blessings. And his father was asked, or he asked himself, is this Yaakov or is this Esav? He felt the coat and he said, it feels like Esav, but sounds like Yaakov. And Yaakov has to go through a similar type of issue and he has to suffer based on that. And he's asked, is this your son's coat or not? So the same way he fooled his father by putting on his brother's coat, his sons fooled him also through Yosef's coat. So we see this always coming back to Yaakov again. This whole incident of stealing the bracha seems to always come back around to Yaakov. He has to deal with this throughout the rest of his life. But we understand that at this point, Reuven felt very alone. He felt sort of liable for what happened. The rest of the brothers didn't feel any remorse. I just want to end reading to you just some words from Rav Hirsch. The story ends at this point, this part of the story ends, that Yaakov says it's Yosef's coat. Yaakov breaks down crying, and he can't be comforted. And he says, I'm going to go down to the grave mourning for my son. He can't bear the pain. Yaakov's had a lot of suffering in his life. Yaakov had to deal with Esav and deal with Laban and deal with his daughter being kidnapped and raped and deal with Rachel dying and deal, all sorts of issues. And now he loses his favorite son. He breaks down. He can't handle it. And he can't comfort himself. Now, just as an aside, the Gemara tells us that Hashem gives a gift to us in this world. What's that gift? We lose a relative. So as painful as it is, the initial feeling of grief eventually fades. We always miss the relative. It always hurts. It's always painful. But the grief that one feels when they first lose a relative, eventually you're able to come to peace with it. You're able to grapple with it. You're able to move on. It doesn't stick with you with that same intensity as it does during the days of Shiva. That's what the Gemara says. That it's a gzeira from Shemayim. Hashem decrees that we forget the pain of losing a loved one, again, to some degree. But over here, Yosef wasn't dead. So Yaakov regarded Yosef as dead, but he wasn't actually dead. So this decree, this divine reality in the world of easing the pain, the grief of losing a loved one, it didn't take effect on Yaakov. Because had Yosef actually been dead, so eventually his grief would be eased. But since Yosef was alive, the pain just lingered because he had lost the child, but the child was still in this world. And the pain lingered and lingered and lingered until he saw him again 22 years later. So that's an important point. Just to read you to you one quote from Rav Hirsch. He's speaking about Reuven and Reuven's remorse and regret over this whole incident. And Reuven says, I can find no place where I can rest quietly, where I can hold my head up. Everywhere, everybody will avoid me. Why should just he have felt like that? So why did Reuven feel this remorse? Quite simply, because he felt himself to blame for not having more energetically acted to oppose and prevent what had happened. He started a mitzvah and then left it. What was behind the lack of energy? He was, after all, the eldest brother. Perhaps because he was not really completely free from fault himself, as conscience now smote and depressed him. The consciousness that in his innermost heart he really had slight leanings in agreement with the brothers. He felt it had prevented his standing up more strongly and energetically against their plans. Let me say it in other words. I think he's describing here a very profound insight to Reuven. On the one hand, Reuven stood up and said, let's save him, let's not kill him. And Reuven, we say he was a little bit lazy with the mitzvah. He didn't carry him back to his father right away. And therefore, he missed his opportunity. But Rav Hirsch says, well, how do you explain this lack of energy, this lack of diligence? Why was Reuven only doing the mitzvah, half-heartedly? Why did he do it that way? So Reverse says, because it could be deep down, Reuven did have feelings like other brothers. It could be deep down, Reuven, on the one hand, was very torn. He said, on the one hand, I want to side with my brothers. I do feel a reason to get rid of Yosef. On the other hand, I'm responsible. I see that Yosef isn't out to do us harm, and I feel I should save him. So sometimes those mixed feelings will cause you to do an act, but only half-heartedly. So he started doing the act of salvation of Yosef, but something held him back. And it's important for us to understand in our own lives. Often we'll do something which is a positive act, but we kind of do it with reservations or hesitation. We don't go full force. And we ask ourselves, why not? And often deep down, it's because, you know what, even though I'm doing this, I don't really feel it. There's something in me which says I shouldn't be doing it. There's something in me that makes me feel torn. And Reuven felt that way. Reuven, on the one hand, felt he should save Yosef. On the other hand, he had slight leanings in agreement with the brothers. And that prevented him from going full force into the mitzvah. So I think it's a fascinating understanding of Reuven's actions over here. It's something that we have to learn for ourselves, to always be in touch with our feelings and to know if I'm doing a mitzvah, I'm only doing it half-heartedly. Like, why? Like, what's holding me back? And often the answer is because deep down inside, something is questioning what you're doing. You don't feel you're not into it for some reason. You have some other feelings that are driving you. Okay, so we'll stop there. And the story that the last verse over here in chapter 37 tells you where Yosef ends up. Now the Midianites had sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, a courtier of Paro, one of his servants, the chamberlain of the butchers. So he's sold into slavery, into the house of Potiphar, who is the chief butcher. And that's where Yosef ends up at the end of the sale. Yeah.
I have a quick question. I mean, we're not up to it yet, but I'm just curious now. Yosef was the first of his brothers to die?
Yeah, he was. He died youngest, 110.
Interesting, because he was one of the younger ones, and yet he was the first to die.
Yeah. It says that Rabbanus Mikaveris is Be'alea. If you get into a position of power, it causes you to die early. as we know, often the stress of taking on responsibility for a tzibur can cause someone to age prematurely, as the rabbis tell us. Yosef, as the king, it made him grow his gray hair earlier on, and he ended up dying early because of it.
Interesting. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful week.
Thank you.
Thank you.